Hi, welcome to the Subway ad for $2.99 subs. How would you like it?
I'll take Drill Sergeant, please.
You got it.
All right, now listen up. I want each and every one of you to drop and give me a 6-inch meatball marinara, cold cut combo, veggie delight, or Black Forest ham on your choice of bread with any veggies you want for just $2.99 each.
Sir, yes, sir!
Subway! Make it what you want at participating restaurants. Additional charge for extras plus applicable tax. No additional discounts or coupons may be applied.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thanks for listening to the Evening Edition. So if you're anything like me, you don't just love watching movies, you also love listening to two complete strangers jabber on about movies. You know, dissecting those themes, comparing and contrasting, digging deep, getting all meta, showing off their deep and profound knowledge of cinema. Which is why you need to check out the all-new At The Movies podcast with my buddy Umapagan Ampige Pagan. I really think he loves talking about movies more than he does watching them. And to listen, just log on to bfm.my/movies.
So I woke up on January the 1st and realized that we were now 16 years into the 21st century. The 21st century. We were living in the actual future, the future of science fiction, the future of science fantasy. We are living in the time and space that people like Jules Verne and Ray Bradbury and Arthur C. Clarke and Isaac Asimov dreamed about. So why does it feel so underwhelming? Why does 2016 feel nothing like what was promised to us on television, in movies, in world's fairs? Whatever happened to the future?
Eureka?
Eureka!
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 This is Eureka on the Evening Edition. I'm Umapagan Ampike Pagan, and today I wanted to take a look at the future. In the TV show Futurama, Philip Fry, a New York City pizza delivery boy, awakens from a millennium of cryogenic slumber to find himself in the year 3000. The first thing he hears is a portentous booming voice.
Welcome to the world of tomorrow!
Why do you always have to say it that way?
Haven't you ever heard of a little thing called showmanship?
The speaker is soon revealed to be a lab technician with a flair for the melodramatic. The scene is a riff on a 70-year-old fair ride, a vision of the future that's been so influential, it'll probably seem familiar to you even if you've never heard of it. The direct reference is to the 1939-1940 New York World's Fair, whose tagline was a promise to show visitors the world of tomorrow.
Way to the $155 million Wonderland. From far and near come countless visitors. By every mode of travel, every means of transportation, they arrive to view the marvels of the greatest exposition in history. Outstanding landmark is the theme center. While the
I used to love the future, or at least visions of the future, the one of flying cars, of backyard nuclear reactors, of colonies on the moon. It was all going to be so wonderful. I could hardly wait for tomorrow to get here. And then something happened. Two great wars, a man on the moon. We just fell out of love with the opportunities that were seemingly just over the horizon. The future went from a great big beautiful tomorrow to a looming nightmare of cataclysmic proportions. And the sad fact of the matter is that the end of my love affair with the future had a lot to do with reality. Tomorrow got here, and it wasn't quite as beautiful as anyone had imagined. Sure, the last century saw some incredible advances in technology, advances that profoundly improved life for the vast majority of the world, but there was also a lot of unexpected baggage. Energy for everyone meant pollution everywhere. An explosion of cheap consumer goods led to landfills spreading across the countryside. Our optimistic future, unfortunately, had a price. The great, big, beautiful tomorrow was focused entirely on the promise of big technology. We Which brings me to the General Motors Pavilion at the 1939-1940 New York World's Fair. Its most memorable feature was a ride called Futurama. People stood in line for hours to ride it and experience the exciting possibilities of life in the distant future, the year 1960. The Futurama ride carried fair visitors past tiny, realistic landscapes while a narrator described the world of tomorrow. The effect was like catching a glimpse of the future from the window of an airplane. As you might expect from a ride sponsored by GM, the focus was on what roadways and transportation might look like in 20 years. The 1939 Futurama had two other factors that compounded the fascination. First, a promise of personal car ownership. And after the Great Depression, that sounded pretty good. And second, a grand vision of the future.
New horizons. In a restless search for new opportunities and new ways of living, the mystery and the promise of distant horizons always have called men forward. First wondering, then searching, then continuing to explore, men have moved on and on, always to find that old horizons opened the way to new horizons.
Up until the Futurama, manufacturers had exhibited at fairs to show how they made their products. And then the Futurama came along and said, here's how the future will actually feel. The 1939 audience wasn't used to having a company sell them optimism, and it made their hearts sing.
In new places, new horizons, roads for men to go places.
GM's ride presented a utopia forged by urban planning. Sophisticated highways ran through rural farmland and eventually moved into carefully ordered futuristic cities. No one had ever considered a future like this. There wasn't an interstate freeway system in 1939, not many people owned a car. They staggered out of the fair like a cargo cult and built an imperfect version of this incredible vision. The original Futurama left an indelible imprint on popular culture, visible in everything from the art and design and science fiction films to forward-looking marketing campaigns to the widespread use of the suffix "-arama."
In the transportation zone, outstanding exhibits by leaders of the auto industry present the highlights of the motor age, amazing conquests of time and space. Monument to mass production that put America on wheels. Here are symbolized the changes the automobile has wrought in our country, contributing to a new way of life, blazing a trail to the road of tomorrow. Sensational is the Futurama that projects you into 1960, the Highways and Horizons show. Railroads are on parade too. Crack foreign streamliners like Britain's Coronation Scott and Italy's 2-mile-a-minute Rome-Naples Express stand side by side with our fastest engines.
It is easy to laugh at the datedness and over-optimism of these futurist exhibits, but we should really resist the urge to dismiss them. These aren't just quaint. They are a caution and an inspiration. They show us just how faulty our intuition about future use of new inventions can be. Most of this stuff was utterly plausible when the rides opened, and it's only in hindsight that we see how weirdly wrong they got everything. That being said, these visions of the future were also an inspiration. They show us that we're pretty good at figuring out what's going to be important in the years to come, even though not necessarily why. Networks are important, but not for video phones. Space is important, you know, for weather satellites, Google Earth spying, GPS, but not necessarily for colonizing. Well, Not so far, anyway. In hindsight, it's easy enough to see that we were one-dimensional in our visions of better tomorrows. But to be fair, at the turn of the last century, technology was producing some truly amazing revolutions. Imagine just how the widespread introduction of electricity, for example, must have felt at the time. As the world literally moved out of the Dark Ages in just a few years, how could we not have been enraptured by the power of science and technology?
A lightning bolt epitomizes man's harnessing of electricity. In this plaza of light, the nation's foremost companies present the magic of today that paves the way for the miracles of tomorrow. Symbols of more power to you and all the world. Signposts are the marvels of the modern electric era.
After this, who was right, Orwell or Huxley? You're listening to Eureka on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
You're listening to Eureka on the Evening Edition. I'm Uma Pagan, I'm PK Pagan, and today I'm taking a look at our one-time predictions of the future. Whatever happened to the future? Go to Shanghai, tilt your head and squint and see the super-dense neon cityscape of Ridley Scott's Blade Runner. The future has been invented again and again in science fiction stories, in altruistic urban plans, in the unbuildable designs of architectural provocateurs. The future has had a long and robust history of taking on new forms within the human imagination. Be they prophecy, speculation, or simple entertainment, such visions have infiltrated the general consciousness, setting grand expectations and perhaps causing some disappointment at the substandard world we're stuck with. But in all of our fictions concerning the future, the scariest predictions have always been about how science and technology interact with our politics.
Ladies and gentlemen, the distinguished author, Mr. Aldous Huxley.
Brave New World is a fantastic parable about the dehumanization of human beings. In the negative utopia described in my story, man has been subordinated to his own inventions. Science, technology, social organization, these things have ceased to serve man. They have become his masters. A quarter of a century has passed since the book was published. In that time, our world has taken so many steps in the wrong direction that if I were writing today, I would date my story not 600 years in the future, but at the most 200. The price of liberty, and even of common humanity, is eternal vigilance.
There are, I suppose, two manifestos, if I could call them that, that still define the visions of our political futures. Huxley's Brave New World and Orwell's 1984. You know the stories. You've most likely referenced them in everyday conversations. But did you know that Huxley believed that his hellish vision of the future was better than Orwell's? In 1949, George Orwell received a curious letter from his former high school French teacher. Orwell had just published his groundbreaking book, 1984, which received glowing reviews from just about every corner of the English-speaking world. And his French teacher, as it happens, was none other than Aldous Huxley, who had taught at Eton for a spell before writing Brave New World, the other great 20th century dystopian novel. Huxley starts off the letter by praising the book, describing it as profoundly important. He continues, and I quote, "The philosophy of the ruling minority in 1984 is a sadism which has been carried to its logical conclusion by going beyond sex and denying it." Then Huxley switches gears and criticizes the book, writing, "Whether in fact the policy of the boot on the face can go on indefinitely seems doubtful. My own belief is that the ruling oligarchy will find less arduous and wasteful ways of governing and of satisfying its lust for power, and these ways will resemble those which I describe in Brave New World." Basically, while praising 1984, Huxley argues that his version of the future was more likely to come to pass.
This is Aldous Huxley, and these are the sounds of the brave new world, of test tube and decanter, of hissing injectors and gurgling blood substitute. The year is AF-632, 632 years after Ford. We are inside the London Hatchery and Conditioning Centre, and this is the fertilising room, an enormous laboratory where the temperature is never allowed to fall below 98.6. And here comes the director of hatcheries and conditioning in person, bringing with him a group
Tomorrow
of young students.
Tomorrow you will be settling down to serious work. Today I just want to give you a general idea of things. These are the incubators, and here is the week supply of ova, kept at blood heat. Come along, boys. Now here, we immerse the eggs into a warm bouillon containing free-swimming spermatozoa. Immersion continues until the eggs are all fertilized. Ah, and over here, here is where we bottle the alphas and betas. In short, gentlemen, the perfect process for manufacturing healthy babies. Are there any questions?
Sir, will you explain the Bakunovsky process?
I'm glad you asked that. Students, take this down. Bakunovsky's process. Where in olden times, one egg made one embryo, which made one baby. Today, we've improved on all that. Now the egg will bud, will divide, from 8 to 96 buds, and every bud will grow into a perfectly formed embryo, and every embryo into a mature baby, making 96 human beings grow where only one grew before. Progress.
Now, in Huxley's seemingly dystopic world state, the elite amuse the masses into submission with a mind-numbing drug called Soma and an endless buffet of casual sex. Orwell's Oceania, on the other hand, keeps the masses in check with fear thanks to an endless war and a hyper-competent surveillance state. At first blush, they might seem like they're diametrically opposed, but in fact, an Orwellian world and a Huxleyan one are simply two different modes of oppression. Obviously, we are nowhere near either dystopic vision, but the power of both books is that they tap into our fears of the state. I'll let you decide which one you think has more likely come to pass. After this, I take a look at some of Isaac Asimov's prediction for the future. You'd be amazed at just how accurate he was. You're listening to Eureka on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Hey, I hope you're really enjoying this podcast. Well, you must be. You've made it this far. Anyway, when you're done listening to this one, don't forget to check out At the Movies with my buddy Umapagan Ampike Pagan. It'll satisfy all your movie podcast cravings, but only after you're done listening to this one. Remember, it's bfm.my/movies.
See the future first at the New York World's Fair. Your visit will be a vacation, an education, an inspiration. Wonder at the world to come. See colonies on the moon and at the bottom of the sea. Thrill to four new spectacles produced by Walt Disney.
You're listening to Eureka on the Evening Edition. I'm Umapagan Ampike Pagan. Today on the show, I'm taking a look at the future. Or rather, a future. One that should have been. Could have been.
To tell you about it is Walt Disney.
Here, for example, is a scale model of the General Electric Carousel Theater. A theater in which the audience itself moves in their seats around the stages. The actors, well, they're not real people, but they are a talented and interesting cast. We call them audio animatronic figures, and they talk and act like human beings. Work in this new type of animation is going on around the clock to meet the opening date of the fair.
Here, humanity's arts and ideas, products and progress will be gathered in a fantasia of friendship and hope. Take a trip to the moon and beyond as you are propelled from the outer reaches of space back to Earth and into the center of the tiniest atom. Narrated by Rod Serling and presented in stereophonic sound and 70mm Spacearium 360 by Cinerama on our 80-foot domed screen. Only at the New York World's Fair.
See you at the fair, and remember,
there's a great big beautiful tomorrow shining at the end of every day. There's a great big beautiful tomorrow, just a dream away.
The New York World's Fair of 1964 is dedicated to peace through understanding. Its glimpses of the world of tomorrow rule out thermonuclear warfare. And why not? If a thermonuclear war takes place, the future will not be worth discussing. So let the missiles slumber eternally on their pads, and let us observe what may come in the non-atomized world of the future. What is to come, through the fair's eyes at least, is wonderful. The direction in which man is traveling is viewed with buoyant hope, nowhere more so than at the General Electric Pavilion. There the audience whirls through four scenes, each populated by cheerful, lifelike dummies that move and talk with a facility that, inside of a minute and a half, convinces you they are alive. The scenes, set in about 1900, 1920, 1940, and 1960, show the advances of electrical appliances and the changes they are bringing to living. I enjoyed it hugely and only regretted that they had not carried the scenes into the future. What will life be like, say, in 2014 AD? 50 years from now, what will the World's Fair of 2014 be like? I don't know, but I can guess.
Now, if we are to believe the predictions of Isaac Asimov, possibly the 20th century's greatest science fiction author, at least I think so, we should all be in therapy. That was just one of his thoughts on an essay he published in 1964 predicting what our world would look like today in the 2000s. The occasion? Well, it was all in conjunction with the World's Fair in Queens, New York. Although the official theme of the fair, which ran for 2 6-month seasons, was peace through understanding, today it's primarily remembered for its vision of the future. And while some of those futuristic technologies on display never quite went mainstream, underwater housing and levitating cars, a closer look at Asimov's World's Fair of 2014 reveals that his crystal ball was shockingly clear. It ran in the New York Times on August 16, 1964.
The appliances of 2014 will have no electric cords, of course, for they will be powered by long-lived batteries running on radioisotopes. The isotopes will not be expensive, for they will be byproducts of the fission power plants, which, by 2014, will be supplying well over half the power needs of humanity. But once the isotope batteries are used up, they will be disposed of only through authorized agents of the manufacturer.
I've got some of my colleagues at BFM, Richard Bradbury, Lim Soon Heng, and Natasha Fusil, reading Asimov's words to you today.
Gadgetry will continue to relieve mankind of tedious jobs. Kitchen units will be devices that will prepare auto meals, heating water and converting it into coffee, toasting bread, frying, poaching, or scrambling eggs, grilling bacon, and so on. Breakfast will be ordered the night before to be ready by a specified hour the next morning. Complete lunches and dinners, with the food semi-prepared, will be stored in the freezer until ready for processing. I suspect, though, that even in 2014, it will still be advisable to have a small corner in a kitchen unit where the more individual meals can be prepared by hand, especially when company is coming.
The world of AD 2014 will have few routine jobs that cannot be done better by some machine than by any human being. Mankind will therefore have become largely a race of machine tenders. Schools will have to be oriented in this direction. Part of the General Electric exhibit today consists of a school of the future in which such present realities as closed-circuit TV and programmed tapes aid the teaching process. It is not only the techniques of teaching that will advance, however, but also the subject matter that will change. All the high school students will be taught the fundamentals of computer technology, will become proficient in binary arithmetic, and will be trained to perfection in the use of the computer languages that will have developed out of those, like the contemporary Fortran.
Communications will become sight sound, and you will see as well as hear the person you telephone. The screen can be used not only to see the people you call, but also for studying documents and photographs and reading passages from books. Synchronous satellites hovering in space will make it possible for you to direct dial any spot on Earth, including the weather stations in Antarctica, shown in chill splendor as part of the 64 General Motors exhibit.
The first transcontinental video call between two places was made on 20th April 1964 using technology developed by Bell Systems, which may have partly inspired Asimov's prediction. But as accurate as he might have been regarding video calling, I'd like to think that even Asimov would have been surprised by the likes of Skype and FaceTime. If not by the technology, then at least by how cheap and accessible they've become. As for Antarctica, you just have to dial country code 672. Well, for some parts, others use New Zealand's country code of plus 64.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, with a great deal of pride and pleasure, I present to you Electro, the Westinghouse Moto Man. Electro, come here. And here he comes, ladies and gentlemen, walking up to greet you under his own power.
Robots will neither be common nor very good in 2014, but they will be in existence. The IBM exhibit at the present fair has no robots, but it is dedicated to computers, which are shown in all their amazing complexity.
You see, all I need to do is to speak into this phone, and Electro does exactly what I tell him to do, sometimes. But I don't see why I'm telling Electro's story when he's perfectly able to tell his own. So let's listen and see what Electro has to say to us today. All right, Electro, will you tell your story, please?
Who? Me?
Yes, you.
Okay, Toots. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll be very glad to tell my story. I am a smart fellow, as I have
if a machines are smart today, what may not be in the works 50 years hence? It will be such computers, much miniaturized, that will serve as the brains of robots.
Asimov is credited with introducing the word robotics into the English language, so it's perhaps no surprise that he was right in predicting that no real robot exists that can rival, say, the Jetsons' housemaid, Rosie, first brought to the screen in 1962. But there are projects underway to get robots to pass Japan's university exams, perform remote surgery, and even cook a gourmet meal. Asimov came close to identifying what has become a crucial component of modern life, miniaturized computers, also known as smartphones, which he thought would serve as the brains of robots. Little did he know that today they also serve as the brains of many people.
By 2014, the four stilts will have been replaced by four jets of compressed air so that the vehicle will make no contact with either liquid or solid surfaces. Jets of compressed air will also lift land vehicles off the highways, which, among other things, will minimize paving problems. Smooth earth or level lawns will do as well as pavements. Bridges will also be of less importance, since cars will be capable of crossing water on their jets, though local ordinances will discourage the practice. Much effort will be put into the designing of vehicles with robot brains. Vehicles that can be set for particular destinations and that will then proceed there without interference by the slow reflexes of a human driver.
Robot brain surely has a better ring than self-driving car, but Asimov's other transport predictions, while just as catchy, still remain the stuff of dreams. The aquafoils, which skimmed over the water with a minimum of friction and impressed World's Fair visitors in 1964, haven't quite caught on. Neither have their successors, jetpacks and hovercrafts. Asimov predicted more, and got more right or semi-right than is possible to list. His fears about population growth and birth control could be the stuff of an entirely separate article. But perhaps his most prescient observation or warning was that while technology both then and now has the power to transform lives, without efforts towards equal access it can hurt rather than help the goal of peace through understanding.
There's a great big beautiful tomorrow shining at the end of every day. There's a great big beautiful tomorrow, and tomorrow's just a dream away. Man has a dream, and that's...
You've been listening to Eureka on the Evening Edition. This is BFM 89.9.
When it becomes a reality, it's a dream come true for you and me. So there's a great big beautiful tomorrow shining at the end of every day. There's a great big beautiful tomorrow, just a dream away. There's a great big beautiful tomorrow.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, welcome to the Subway ad for $2.99 subs. How would you like it?
I'll take Drill Sergeant, please.
You got it. All right, now listen up. I want each and every one of you to drop and give me a 6-inch meatball marinara, cold-cut combo, veggie delight, or Black Forest ham on your choice of bread with any veggies you want for just $2.99 each.
Sir, yes, sir!
Subway! Make it what you want at participating restaurants. Additional charge for extras plus applicable tax. No additional discounts or coupons may be applied.